This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we welcome back civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart to discuss the recent murder of Larry Davis in an upstate New York prison.
Some called him a hero, some called him a common criminal. Lynn Stewart was one of his defense attorneys and will tell you the facts.
We'll talk with author Al McCoy about his appearance in the recent Oscar-winning documentary, Taxi to the Dark Side.
You remember Al. Al wrote The Question of Torture, taking U.S. torture techniques back to the famed Kubark Manual, where the CIA spent hundreds of millions to develop various ways of torturing people in custody.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we welcome back civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart to discuss the recent murder of Larry Davis in an upstate New York prison. Davis became known in the 1980s when he was suspected of murdering drug dealers in New York City. When police raided his apartment, Davis fired a pistol and shotgun from a darkened room and fled. After more than a two-week NYPD manhunt, he was captured. Davis's legal defense included Lynn Stewart and prominent civil rights attorney Bill Kunstler, who provided evidence of a police frame-up. In a recent New York Times article chronicling Davis's story, it was written that Davis's defense was, quote, made up of assertions without evidence. Here to dispute that is Lynn Stewart. Lynn, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Nice to be back once again.
We'd like to start by having you read your letter to the New York Times, which hasn't yet been published, about the murder of Larry Davis.
Yes, I wrote this the day after I read the article in the Times, and I think it tells it all. Let me just read it. To whom it may concern, the editors of the New York Times. My friend and co-counsel Bill Kunstler must be spinning in his grave over the Times' team coverage of the murder of Larry Davis. It is replete with errors and, unfortunately, the kind of innuendo usually garnered by the more strident tabloids of this city. No one asked me, but I was in that Bronx courtroom with Larry Davis for almost 2 years. I tried the first two cases. The prosecution elected to try a quintuple murder first because they thought it was a slam dunk and that they would never have to cope with the ugly facts besmirching the so-called honest cops on the raid that cold November night. They lost the first case because a racially mixed jury, including a state trooper's sister from Riverdale, saw an obvious frame-up, no matter how many witnesses they called. The trial of the cop case the following year was tried as a classic self-defense. It was revealed that after threats were delivered to Larry's mother, 36 policemen and women descended on that Morrisania apartment. Some had liquor on their breath. At least one had a shotgun. They were accompanied by the elite emergency service unit, who testified at trial that although the plan was for them to gain entrance, one of the detectives got past them and rushed into the apartment. Gunfire erupted. The most crucial evidence, all you fans of CSI take note, was the testimony of criminologist for the defense Peter DeForest, who stated under oath the scientific facts of the trajectory of a shotgun slug recovered at the scene. It became absolutely clear to that jury, who deliberated for almost 3 weeks, that the police fired first at Larry Davis, entitling him legally to fire back with a .45 pistol defending himself. If anyone had checked the Times day-to-day coverage of the trial back in 1988, these facts were apparent. As to the alleged police corruption, it was simply suggested by the defense as a motivation for one or more to commit murder, and certainly no surprise after the Mollen Commission, the Dirty 30, and recent reports of the South Brooklyn Narcotic Group. Prosecution never disproved it, and as I said in summation, it only takes a few to have a plan and the blue line to thereafter cover it up. If they went there to arrest Larry Davis, where was the warrant? The crucial part of your story is the people living in the projects calling Larry, Larry, out the window as he was arrested. His self-defense against an antagonistic, well-armed, superior force is the stuff of legend, particularly our American model. Those folks still live in those projects and in the tenements of Bushwick and Harlem and Washington Heights. They still consider Larry a hero, especially after Louima, Diallo, and Bell. They may not read the Times, but would surely disagree with your initial assertion that the chronicle of Larry Davis was over. As long as there is aggression and oppression, there will be resistance. Sincerely, Lynn Stewart.
It's a beautiful letter,
yeah,
Louise.
Lynn,
thank you for writing
a moving letter.
Mean, how did you feel when you first heard the news?
I'll tell you a couple of things that are not in the letter also. Of course, I was very upset. I actually heard it from a friend here in the city who heard it from her garbage man who knocked on her door to tell her that he had heard it, knowing that she was an activist. So, you know, and then we checked it out and found it on the web, of course. That was on Thursday morning when it was just a breaking story. I tell you, though, what really got to me finally was, and I say which upset me a lot, the person who murdered Larry Davis was also a client of mine.
Oh, my. Wow. What was his name?
His name is Louis Rosado, nicknamed Blue Boy. He was one of the first cases I ever tried as a not so young lawyer, but as a beginning lawyer. It was a murder case. He went to jail at the age of 19. He's now 41. We haven't stayed in touch, but we have, the occasional letter, I'm having a problem with this, or could you check this out for me? To me, you know, the juxtaposition of these two young men and knowing what we know, both of these, here's a young Latino from the Lower East Side, a young black man from the South Bronx.
Larry went in about the same age, right?
Right, right. He was a little older than that, I would say. He was maybe 20
right.
By the time all these trials eventually got over. I said to Ralph, we have to coin a new phrase. You remember we used to say, last hired, first fired, and it was a catchphrase. I said, with regard to the system now, I think we have to say, first they fail these kids in the school systems, then they jail them, and then they spend large periods of their time in jail. That really did shake me up. You know, as a lawyer, you have relationships with every client. Whether no matter who they are, you still have some kind of a relationship with them. It took me a day or so to shake off this feeling of this is almost too much for me, too much.
Have you been in communication with Larry since his?
I tell you, Larry and I split under a mutual agreement. He wanted to pursue radios and movies, and he felt that certain people were going to forward that part of his outlook and career. And the people he was associating with were not my favorite people, namely Arl Sharpton, et cetera. So who I thought was exploiting him, shame. shamelessly and told him so, and he told me, this is typical Larry, and I'm not speaking ill of the dead, but typical Larry said, Lynn, you just don't know how to handle people. And I, of course, rejoined, well, I don't, and I'm never going to learn either.
Let me go back for a second a little bit, because there were two cases you tried where you had him acquitted, which you described in your letter. And then there's a role of Bill Kuntzler also, and then eventually he got convicted. So can you bring us up what Bill's role was and what happened in the trial that he got convicted?
Okay, it's interesting because it starts out with Stanley Cohen. That's another name out there these days.
Progressive lawyer, for those who don't know.
Progressive lawyer, right, does many, many Muslim and Native American cases. He was working for Legal Aid at the time up in the Bronx, and he, of course, was a senior, and he got this case only to find out that Legal Aid was conflicted out of it because initially they arrested another young man along with Larry for this quintuple murder. So he suggested to Mrs. Davis, Larry's mother, that maybe she would like to go down and talk to Bill about whether he could do the case.
This is Bill Kuntzler.
Bill Kuntzler, yes, exactly. Bill and I, at that point, had been on trial together through the trial of the United Freedom Front in the Eastern District of New York.
What was that?
That was a bombing case by underground people, including my own dear Pat Levasseur, who works for me.
Who worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights after that.
Exactly, yeah. She was basically, the only thing she got convicted of ever was harboring a fugitive. Her husband, it happened to be. But at any rate, this case where no one was hurt, all the targets were things like South African Airways, IBM for building cluster bombs, General Electric, various naval reserve stations. It was classic political bombing in the sense that we can get you anytime you want, so you better think about what you're doing.
That's the United Freedom Front case you tried with Bill.
With Bill, right, in the Eastern District. We tried it to a mixed result. Everybody was convicted of something, but basically much less than what they were originally charged with. That case basically then moved up to Springfield, Mass., where they tried a sedition case tried by no less than Robert Mueller, now a name known to us as head of the FBI, who got his teeth kicked in that case, I'm happy to report, at the hands of Liz Fink and some other folks whose names, Linda Thompson, and some other folks whose name I'm not, Bill. But at any rate, and Ray Levasseur representing himself, the women who were charged were all acquitted, and the men all got hung juries. So the government elected not to retry that case. The jury in that case is still friendly with the defendants. And actually, when I went up to do a fundraiser up there, the jury came out to the fundraiser.
Now, neither of those cases were Larry Davis
cases. Neither of those cases were Larry Davis.
Because this is how you got you and Bill.
You see, you
somehow.
Get an old lawyer.
We can have a whole history
An
here.
Old lawyer to start telling war stories, and you see what happens. It becomes
you
elliptical.
You were talking about having worked with Bill before and working with him on the Davis case.
After this United Freedom Front case, we went to New Jersey and we tried the case of Tom Manning and Richard Williams for the murder of Trooper LaMonaco on Route 80. Bill and I were on a daily basis seeing each other during this time because we'd pick him up on Gay Street. We'd drive over to New Jersey. So he says to me, Mrs. Davis, Larry Davis's mother's coming to see me. What do you think? And I said, well, is she coming to offer you the case? I said, I know Stanley Cohen can't do it. He said, I think she is. But he said, Lynn, I don't think this is my kind of a case.
This is the first Larry Davis indictment for the murder of five supposed drug dealers. Is that right? I don't know.
After Larry was arrested, then they indicted him for four different incidents. At this point, he had the four cases. No one knew. Everyone assumed they would try the police shooting first. That was the sexy case. To go back to the story, though, Bill said, I don't think this is my kind of case. What do you think? I said, Bill, are you crazy? It's a self-defense case. Eleanor Bumpers, all these poor people that have been murdered in this city. It cries out for you. It cries out for you to defend them. Of course it's your kind of case. I said, it's not your typical case. The guy's framed. They're putting him in here because he's political. I said, this kid isn't political at all. I'm sure he's a street kid, but he did the right thing under the circumstances. Bill says, well, I'll do it if you'll do it with me. So, of course, I said, of course I will. And the next time the case was on in the Bronx, the two of us trekked up there. And I was assigned to the quintuple murder. Bill was assigned to the police shooting. The Bronx DA, as I said and alluded to in my letter, elected to go with the quintuple murder because I think they thought they could convict Larry of that and then he would plead out to everything else. I never have to bring these cops onto the witness stand. But that jury really did see through it, and that was a very unusual jury. It's one of the court officers in the Bronx told me that when they went into the jury room after the verdict, everything they had written on paper was torn into teeny, teeny bits of paper. Didn't trust anybody, didn't trust the press, didn't trust anybody. They acquitted on that first case. And then, of course, we had tried that case, though, as a frame-up and put in a lot of the same information that we eventually put in the second case,
the police.
With the police.
We always said, Bill and I, chortling to each other, said the biggest mistake they made in the Bronx was when we said, you know, this case is really too big for one lawyer. We really think we both ought to be assigned to both cases. And they did it. And was their big mistake because... and I always love this. The New York Times, in writing about the case after the summation, said, Lynn Stewart and Bill Kunstler danced around the prosecutors who were like Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble. They were just like Fred and Ginger. They just danced right around them. I said, what greater praise.
Well, I miss you guys in the courtroom, both of you. So.
Lynn, now what did Larry ultimately serve time for?
Well, he was convicted of possessing the weapon with which she used in self-defense. That's New York's little anomalous law. You can shoot someone with a gun in self-defense and be acquitted for that, but you can't be acquitted of the possession of the weapon. So, and of course, the judge, being a servant of the community, end quote, sentenced him to 15 years, 5 to 15 years, the maximum he could get for that.
Got 15. Was that his only sentence he was serving when he was killed?
No. The saga continues. Bill and I got off the case. Michael Warren, also a name well known to your listening audience, Tarif Warren, he took over Larry's case at that point. He tried to an acquittal in Manhattan for a shooting, a death in Manhattan, using the same framework, the frame up, you know, the police, et cetera. He got an acquittal in Manhattan.
So at this point, you have three acquittals on the main cases and one conviction on the possession of a gun.
Weapons, right. Then, of course... Just like in the movie or the book, The Natural, it's always the one you're not looking for that gets you. The fourth case was also tried by Michael, and this was tried in the Bronx. This case was haywire from the beginning, I think. I really don't know a lot about it, but I do know it involved a murder through a closed door, someone shooting someone through a closed door, and they had only circumstantial evidence. But Larry was convicted of that, and that, of course, accounted for the bulk of the time. He got 25 to life for that.
What was it like working with Bill and trying those cases?
Fun. We always had a good time. We had our differences. For me, it's the politics first and don't besmirch them. And of course, Bill, being what his own dear Margie Ratner, his wife, calls a loose cannon at times, he would do impromptu press conferences and say some things that would rankle me terrifically. But by and large, it was a very amicable relationship. And it started because, you know, I am a preparation freak. I still am.
Unlike
Bill, exactly. Well, it was a compliment.
The only thing I know about Bill in that, I mean, I don't know about Bill during trial. Look, he'd done 220 jury trials at least by the time he died. So I don't think he had to do as much as maybe I would have had to do in my first to second. But I know on summations he worked like a dog.
Yeah.
And I remember going over to his house many times that he would really work out his summations. And you would have to shut his door to his room. You know, he might occasionally get a migraine, and he would just work on them like a dog.
Yes. Now, you see, he was lucky in these cases. Maybe that's why he said, will you do the case with me? Because I summed up in both cases,
okay,
you see.
I got you.
But he did the openings. Uh-huh. It was all very strategically done. We knew what kind of a tough case we would have, but we also knew we had some tremendous ammunition here. You know, if we just got it out there and organized. And you're right. You know, Bill didn't need to prepare in the same sense. I mean, we became firm friends at this initial trial we did together. We sat next to each other, and I would get up first and cross-examine. And then he would take my folder, and he would get up and cross-examine with the same paperwork.
You're kidding.
No.
They allowed two of you to cross-examine the same witness?
Oh, yeah. Well, we each represented different people.
Oh, I see. So two people.
Yeah,
okay,
I remember.
Right.
But, you know, the art of representing people is to be able to tell a story. And I can't think of two better storytellers than Lynn Stewart
you,
and Bill Kunstler.
No, Smith
absolutely.
Is pretty good at stories also.
Yes, absolutely.
But Lynn and Bill, I would agree that...
And he had certain witnesses he loved to cross-examine. He loved medical people. Oh, doctors were his meat, you know.
Really?
Because,
know
well,
that.
You know, his father was a,
father
doctor,
was a doctor,
so he had total contempt for them. And he would get up there with his wonderful big voice
right.
and say, well, doctor, you can't name. And he also loved, police ballistics people and things like that, you know. And he would say, well, what's your background in this? And the guy inevitably we'd say something like, well, I was with the U.S. Army in 1963. And he'd say, where were you based? And then the guy would say, if he had any brains, he would just say Georgia or something. But if he dared say something like Central America, oh, then Bill was off to the race. You were part of the group that was sent to Central America to deal with the... And of course... He would always get in somehow or other that he had been Martin Luther King's lawyer.
Yeah. The jury liked to hear that.
Oh, well, a Bronx jury, you believe it. They loved
funny.
It. They loved him.
Yeah.
Yes, right. We, yeah. It was a great trial, and it was a great trial because we had, and I have to also add, I'm going to plump a little for my own darling, Ralph Pointer, who was the investigator on this case. And who
Your
went,
husband.
My husband, kidding. Yes. Who went into the apartment where this police action took place, and they basically cut and run. They never did any real. He found things in there. He made measurements in there the first day. I mean, and more importantly that, he bonded with Larry.
Yeah.
Larry saw Ralph as a, they have an expression on the street, an OG, an old gangster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ralph was Larry's OG, even though Ralph was an OG with principles. And so he and Larry got along, and he kept Larry on a steady path. In that last trial, he kind of went bananas a little bit. He got off on accusing the judge of criminal activity, all sorts of wild things. But during our two trials, he and Ralph were very tight, and Ralph did develop the witnesses that were really scared to come forward, to feel that they could come forward and tell the truth.
Let me ask a question about prisons a little bit, because the article I read in the Times, of course, had the man who killed Larry having a knife that he had either self-fashioned or a shank. I mean, how common is that in prison? Is that something prevented? I mean, do you have any sense in a broader scheme apart from what happened in this individual case?
They're very vigilant, is my view has always been. I mean, they're always turning people out, you know, meaning that they say everybody out in the yard or everybody into the cafeteria or whatever it is and search, tearing their whole rooms apart, all their paperwork, punitive kind of searches. And I tell you, some people, such as Alambe Brath, who is an activist and an Africa specialist, but who has lived in Harlem all of his life, and who basically was part of the post-conviction support group for Larry. He worked to try to raise money for Larry's appeal. He and the December 12th movement had activities, you know, to remember Larry Davis. And he immediately, when he called me, and Bob Fass, also on this station, who was, you know, an old-timer who had Allen Ginsberg on in the 50s, both of them, when they called me, both had the same thing. They tried to kill him once. They couldn't do it. Now they did it.
Do you think there's any truth to that?
I don't know. I really don't know. Someone said it's an awful long time ago. Mm. But, you know, the police memory is also very long. And they were very unhappy, always, up to the point where when I was speaking in Goshen, New York, a few years ago about my case, one of these detectives got up in the back of the room and said, I'm one of the cops that Larry Davis shot. And are you going to lie to these people like you lied to that jury? And before I could answer this question, he ran out of that place. But the need, can you imagine, 20 years later to come forward to confront me on a situation, it was unbelievable to me. It is peculiar. Yeah. It's also true. Larry had 75 infractions, prison infractions from the time he was in there, and Louis Rosato had something like 32. Mm. I hope that an industrious lawyer gets the wrongful death case and really investigates. And it could be that they just turned a blind eye to it.
Is Louis Rosato been charged with anything?
He's charged with the murder.
Yeah.
He's charged with the murder.
The stories and what you did in your legal career is extraordinary to me.
Extraordinary.
It's really moving to hear this.
Thank you, Michael. And you know, the letter came out of that. Larry was a very, very important case for me. You know, I've tried a lot of big cases since then and before then and had lots of name recognition clients. But, you know, this was the one that really, to anyone that was around in those days, it hit such a nerve.
Yeah.
It was, people couldn't believe he was acquitted by reason of self-defense. It really was a lightning rod.
What year were those two trials?
88. He was arrested in 86. The first trial was in 87. And then the second trial was in 88. Ed Koch opined that you couldn't use self-defense against the police.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
And I also just want to remark that the Daily News coverage reported that a police lieutenant, who was supposedly in charge of the operation, his name did not ring a bell with me, but at any rate, he commented to the Daily News that the prison system did what the justice system couldn't do.
Wow.
This guy should support the Ku Klux Klan.
That's exactly. We can name 100 we could support under that theory. Yeah, but it shows the mentality of the police that are out there and policing in the boroughs.
And it showed the underlying corruption in some of these precincts where these cops really were dirty.
Right.
And
meanwhile,
and were able to bring
we
that
have
out.
The Sean Bell case going on now, and it's in this climate that we hope justice will prevail.
Lynn, yes, exactly.
Stick around. We want you back. Thank you very much, Lynn Stewart.
I'm try.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you. Taxi to the Dark Side is the title of an Oscar-winning documentary that examines the use of torture by the United States. The horrors of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and Bagram are revealed in this movie with disturbing and ugly clarity. The award got relatively little notice in the press, as with many movies critiquing the Iraq War. We talk again about the film with author Al McCoy, who wrote the book A Question of Torture. Professor McCoy appears in the documentary as himself.
Professor Alfred McCoy from the University of Wisconsin, you won an Oscar. You participated in the making of a documentary film that won the Oscar, Taxi to the Dark Side. Congratulations on all your good work, and especially for this. What does it feel like to be a part of an Oscar-winning documentary?
It's how could I put it? It's a tremendous affirmation. You know, when you work in the subject of torture, which is so fraught, so deeply disturbing, and you come up with an argument that says that the events at Abu Ghraib and at Bagram prison in Afghanistan were not the work of bad apples, but the result of government policy decisions taken at the top that percolate downward through the chain of command, this use of torture techniques that aren't accidents, but in fact were developed during the Cold War by the CIA and have persisted to the present. That's an enormously controversial thesis. You get attacked. It's a tremendous sense of validation to have those ideas get into a documentary and have that documentary receive this affirmation from the Academy. Moreover, that award is very important because we are at a critical issue in the whole torture debate. We're now moving into an election with John McCain as a Republican nominee. It means inevitably in the debates there are going to be, by both the Democratic and Republican nominee, questions asked about torture. And so the Bush administration's policy of using torture in defiance of treaty and U.S. law to pursue our enemies is either going to be affirmed or it's going to be changed. And it won't be just simply the excesses or the aberrations of one administration. It now could become U.S. policy. And the consequences of that for both the United States and the U.S. reputation in the world are very grave. So, in effect, we may be tired of this issue. We may be exhausted by it. We may be repulsed of it. We don't want to think about it anymore. We've seen those photographs countless times. But nonetheless, we're not done with it, and it's not done with us. And this film is therefore coming out at this critical and almost perfect moment to help the American people engage this issue and make a very important decision.
Well, thank you, Al. This is Michael Ratner, and thank you for being on our show in the past. Professor Alfred McCoy, who wrote the book The Question of Torture, and is now of recent fame for playing in a very important role. The fact that Taxi to the Dark Side won an Academy Award did not get a lot of media attention. Was your perception as well, and what do you attribute that to?
Actually, looking at the New York Times coverage, for example, I think it's just an accident of the Academy Awards, because when the Times goes to press, they basically are only able to capture the first hour or maybe an hour and a half of the awards. So it's all the minor awards. And then the next day, of course, it's already old news. So they do kind of long-term retrospective or prospective coverage. And so it really kind of, because the award for Taxi to the Dark Side came after the Metropolitan Dailies on the East Coast went to bed, it kind of missed that coverage. But I think that not so much the immediate coverage by the New York Times, which at best would only be a couple of sentences and is not sufficient to engage the issue. What's really important right now is that because of the imprimatur of the Academy Award, that film is going to get cinema releases way beyond the few art cinemas that have hosted the film up to this point. It's already got a sale. Alex Gibney, the director, has sold it to HBO, which has a huge audience.
And Discovery Channel refused, prior to the Academy Awards, refused to put it on. Can you bring us up to date on that?
My understanding was reading the press from Alex Gibney. What happened was is that, I don't know the details of it, but basically Discovery Channel wouldn't put it on this year. Okay, they wouldn't. They're not going to show it before the Academy Awards. They weren't going to put it on this year.
Wow.
And so HBO agreed to put it on this year. In other words, I think what Discovery Channel was going to do, in order to kind of show, they usually feature what? Elephants and cute little varmints,
Right? I like Rumsfeld.
This is not their thing, right? And so they wanted to be nonpartisan. So they kept it out. They were going to keep it out of the election cycle.
I got you. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and by HBO putting it on this year, that means it's going to be right there. Now, look, we all know what's going to happen when either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama stands up on the debate podium with John McCain. Because John McCain is a former POW, because he was tortured by the North Vietnamese, and because he's taken a strong position, although it's been mingled and muddied of late. But
right, let's just point that out. The last vote he took, as I'm sure you follow, was against applying the field manual restricted army interrogation techniques to the CIA. And he gave a really a mind-bending, ridiculous, weak-kneed excuse for doing that.
Yeah, I know. It's almost like he's undone his previous work, his previous independent stand, in order to curry favor with the Republican right. So McCain is actually, because, first of all, he's an iconic figure on the issue of torture, and second, because he's compromised his position of late, you know that he's going to get that those questions are going to come to the debate. First of all, they're going to come to him about flip-flopping, then they're going to come to him about his personal experience. So this issue is going to be right there in the debates, and the Democratic candidate is going to have to be able to deal with this, and so the public is going to have to respond on this issue.
It's conceivable that the Democrats could leave this alone because they don't want to be painted as weak on national security, and particularly on that same vote that McCain voted no in terms of applying the Army Field Manual, neither Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton was there to vote.
Right.
So they're not in the strongest position of taking on McCain on that vote.
And that's why it's dangerous. Right now, McCain has moved over to the conservative Republican position, basically backing the Bush administration's decision to use torture in violation of law and treaty. And, you know, if he sticks to that position in the debates, what could wind up happening is that we would have an affirmation of the Bush administration's torture policy through the electoral process.
That's what I'm afraid of.
And that's when so it's a very dangerous time. Because if McCain runs essentially on the Republican position of pro-torture, which is what the position has been, and pro-Guantanamo, then what we're going to have is an administration, potentially, if it's McCain, taking office, affirming the Bush administration policy, and with an electoral mandate, an affirmation of that, where the American people would have considered the issue and, by implication, approved the policy. So it's a very dangerous time. The issue is not over, and that's why this documentary, getting out into the public arena, being seen by millions, and hopefully shifting the public position on this away from support for torture, because the American public has generally supported torture. Media coverage we've had up to this point has been shows like 24, which celebrate torture as absolutely essential for the defense of the nation.
Professor Alfred McCoy, he's a scholar on the question of torture, which is the title of his book, and he was a key participant in the production of the movie Taxi to the Dark Side.
We go now to hear a clip from the film, Taxi to the Dark Side.
This debate is occurring because of the Supreme Court's ruling that said that we must conduct ourselves under the Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And that Common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. What does that mean?
I know whether it was an injury that was aggravated by something, or whether he was just sick coming in. I saw his picture in the New York Times article. Before that picture, I couldn't have picked his face out, you know? My memory of him was chained up with the hood on, no sleeping.
This is not a hotel. This is not a place for them to get fat and lazy and happy.
They told us when dealing with the PUCs, as they called them, the persons under U.S. custody, they don't fall under Geneva Conventions. Basically, the only thing that we weren't allowed to do is beat them up.
We have to work sort of the dark side, if you will. We're going to spend time in the shadows. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies.
Soldiers are dying. Get the information. That's all you're told. Get the information.
Sometimes I feel that I should have gone with my own morality more than what was common.
Some would say, well, hey, you should have stopped this. You should have stopped that. Why didn't you do something?
That'd be a good question. My answer would be, well, you know, it was us against them. I was over there. I didn't want to appear to be going against my fellow soldiers. Which, is that wrong? You could sit here and say that was dead wrong. Go over there and say that.
People say, well, these photographs from Abu Ghraib, they weren't real torture. I look back at those people and I say, murder's torture. Murder's the ultimate torture.
One by one, the terrorists are learning the meaning of American justice.
If they think so very little of life, and clearly 9/11 exemplified that, screw them. Anything goes.
That was a clip from the film, Taxi to the Dark Side.
It's going to be in theaters, we hope, now that it won the Oscar, and we urge everybody to go out and see it. Al, tell me, what's been your perception of Barack Obama's position on this whole question?
He's been very terse. The Democrats, you see, in the kind of cut and thrust of partisan debate, it's a difficult issue because the Republicans can simply stand up and say, we're strong on defense. We will do what needs to be done to defend America. That's their rhetorical line. That's the way Bush does it. It's all done in these kind of oblique references, these euphemisms. President Bush refers to torture as, for example, alternative methods, CIA alternative methods, or sometimes he calls it the CIA program. And he stands up, as he did in September 2006, in the East Room of the White House with 9/11 families, and he uses this rhetoric, and we all know what he's talking about. He's saying, when he says alternative CIA program or methods, he means torture.
Certainly.
Okay, and everybody knows that. And so when the Republicans say, we will do what needs to be done to defend America, that sounds, you know, resolute and determined, and the Democrats are then in a very difficult position of trying to unpack that rhetoric, give it nuance. At the same time, they've got to look like they're standing strong for national defense and security. So it's a very difficult area for them. And that's why it's very important to have a public debate to bring out what torture really means in the public arena. So when the Republicans trot out these euphemisms, people won't simply sort of stand up and salute. Let's take the issue of waterboarding. What's really been interesting is the way that that single technique has really kind of helped define the public debate. And one of the problems that I think we're facing on the waterboarding issue is that people simply don't understand what we're talking about. I mean, we had the situation where, you know, Judge Mukasey, now our Attorney General, came before the U.S. Senate and feigned not knowing what waterboarding was. And the Democratic Senator from Rhode Island had to sit there and said, here's what waterboarding is. Now that I've explained it to you, do you think it's legal or illegal? He's never clarified that position.
And Cheney says for him it's a no-brainer.
And this is what I find at this point actually a little bit upsetting, is that nobody really understands that waterboarding is arguably the cruelest technique of any torture technique imaginable. If you want, I can explain why.
I'd like you to do that, please.
Okay. Look, do you guys know... I'm sorry to treat you like students in one of my seminars, but do you guys know what the mammalian diving reflex is?
No.
Okay, we've all got it. It's in our heads. Okay, let me ask you a question. If you were a child right now, you're driving along and you went out into the East River with your grandchild or your child in the back of your car, and that child was, let's say, 11 months old, how long do you think that child could stay alive in the freezing water of the East River?
3 minutes.
You're wrong. That child could be pulled up within 30 minutes. And not only would the child be alive, but the child would have no brain damage. And that sounds crazy because an adult is dead in about 3 or 4 minutes. And if the adult is deprived of oxygen, the brain is severely damaged. What happens is we have this thing inbuilt in us called the mammalian diving reflex. And for an infant, the body shuts down all of the organs and husbands the oxygen in the lungs and sends it up to the brain to keep the one organ that must have oxygen in order to stay alive and not suffer damage, the brain. And so we have within us, as a result of this mammalian diving reflex, this deep biological terror of water and drowning. It's that hard into our systems.
It's in the human biology. This is not culture. This is deep. And so when water constricts our breathing, the body, okay, tells the mind, you're dying. This is more dramatic, more direct than taking a gun and putting it up to the head, which is illegal.
Yeah, okay? Yeah. When we interviewed Henri Alleg, he said it was like being overcome by the feeling of death.
Yes, right. Alleg is the first person that ever accurately described. He said in his words, is it's a feeling like death itself. And it's just a little phrase he has in his very famous book on torture. We didn't know about the mammalian diving reflex. He didn't know about that in the 1950s. It wasn't defined really by medical science till the 1970s and 80s. And what it was is there were a whole series of incidents around the world. For example, the first came in Holland in the canals after World War II, where cars went off into the cold waters of the canal. They pulled a kid out after 20 minutes thinking the child would be dead. The child wasn't dead. The child was alive. They would think there was brain damage. No, there was no brain damage. The child was perfectly fine. How could this be? It's because of the mammalian diving reflex. So Alleg was describing, yes, it is death. Every time you do this, this is not simulated drowning. This is drowning. And moreover, it's not just drowning, it's fear of death. It's like you're playing Russian roulette, except it's many times more powerful.
And this is what Cheney approved. This is what went on at Guantanamo. This is what the CIA wants to be allowed to do.
Yep.
This is what Mukasey, the new attorney general, won't comment on because they don't want people prosecuted for it. This is what's been illegal in the United States by domestic and international law going all the way back. This is a torture technique that was developed in the times of the Inquisition. We're speaking with Al McCoy about, is this going to even be discussed, this election period?
You mentioned that it's a torture technique from the Inquisition. Indeed, in the 1500s, the French Inquisition, not the Spanish, the French Inquisitions published a manual of interrogation. They had graphic illustrations of this method, and they called it, and you could actually look at it. There's a magistrate sitting on a high bench. There's a clerk of the court with a volume open and a quill pen in hand. After all, this is 1560, is the date of this illustration. The victim is prone, arms bound, and then there's a cloth over the victim's mouth. The perpetrator is pouring water over a cloth, which is over the victim's mouth. And in the manual at the top, okay, this is in the 16th century, the French Inquisition, when they knew what was torture and what was not torture, I mean, I think we'd all agreed in the 16th century they knew what was torture, okay? And this technique is labeled torturae gallicae ordinariae, which is Latin for standard French torture.
Yeah.
Okay? It is exactly the same technique. There's two ways of doing waterboarding. One is the way that the French paratroopers did it against Henri Alleg. You stick a tube down the throat past the choke point, and you pour the water directly into the lungs. And you fill up the lungs with water, and then you hold it for a couple of minutes, and then you pound on the lungs, and the victim vomits out the water. Okay. The other way of doing it is the CIA's technique, which is exactly the same as the French Inquisition used in the 16th century, is you put a cloth over the nose and mouth and you pour water. Now, why would that arouse such panic? Because it's the water. The water triggers the mammalian diving reflex, and the body tells the mind, you are dying. Mm. You are dying. You are dead. The fear and panic of that. This is not near death. This is death. The body is telling the mind that you are dying. This is the most terrifying thing that can happen to any human being. It's the greatest fear we all have. And you do it not once and not twice, not three times, four times. It just keeps on going. You die. You die a dozen deaths. And the trauma is just extraordinary. And Dick Cheney calls this a little dunk in the water. And the other thing is, the rest of the world knows exactly what this is. The French, the Europeans, they know. When they see us calling this barbarous torture technique a little dunk in the water, when we have the supreme law enforcer in the United States, the U.S. Attorney General, saying he's not sure it's torture, the Europeans, you know, they look at us like we're barbarians. And our prestige, our world leadership, plummets.
Thank you very much. Professor Alfred McCoy from the University of Wisconsin, the author of On the Question of Torture, and most recently a participant in the award-winning documentary Taxi to the Dark Side, which will hopefully be in a lot of theaters around the country now. And we're very, very grateful for the work you do on this question. It's a crucial time for Americans, and we hope that our listeners will get out there and talk to other people, see this movie, read Professor McCoy's book, and let's see whether we can turn this country around. Thank you very much, Al McCoy.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org.